Hi guys, my name is Mike. I'm the general manager at Arena Marketing Cafe. And with me today is Steve Olive. Steve's got an art show in Gualala happening right now, art and science exhibit show.
Yes.
And we're going to talk a lot about that maybe, and we're going to discuss a lot of the story of how he came to come here. Mm-hmm. Not going to take all the time in the world, but there's a whole lot of story, so we may end up in the weeds. It'll be fun. Okay. Yeah. So the first question, of course, for me, you're doing a show in Gualala, and it's all about light and art and stuff. And so why did you decide that you wanted to do something, especially because you're talking about it's an alternative way of approaching light?
Yes. Well, an alternative way of teaching color.
Okay.
And what I've been working on ideas about teaching color for many, many years. And Seuss offered me the opportunity to have a Gualala art show, which is kind of a prestigious thing, and I appreciated it. And a year ago, I said, yeah, sure, and then all of a sudden, here it was.
Right, that happens quick.
Yeah. But I've been working on these ideas. See, I learned color theory from the bottom of a Play-Doh pack.
Okay.
When I was in the third grade. And I've been teaching color theory to kids in schools probably for 15 years. I've taught classes at Manchester, Point Arena, Horicon, Kauai, back in Black Mountain, North Carolina. I mean, all over the place, as well as teaching adult professionals in Ireland.
Do you start with a Play-Doh pack as well?
I start with a traditional Play-Doh pack, because the Play-Doh, it says it's red, yellow, and blue, but it's not red.
Nope.
It's cyan, magenta, and yellow, the printing colors.
Yeah.
And then you make a color wheel with that, and then you put a spot of white in the middle, then you can make all these lovely pastel colors.
Yep.
And then when you mix the threes, you get your grays and browns, you put those outside the color wheel. But what I found is that since everyone learns in a different way, what I found was that Play-Doh, because you have the tactile sensation of rubbing it together and watching the colors change, there's a very distinctive smell.
Retention.
And then every kid will taste it at least once. It's very salty. Then you make these beautiful colors on your color wheel, and with the teacher talking about it, you've hit all five senses.
Yep.
And Mike, what I've learned is that since everybody learns in a different way, all you have to do is hook them on any one of their senses to get their attention, and then they're open to learning.
I like that.
Yeah.
So is your project there, is it actually a five-sense receptive introduction to color? Is that what you're doing?
It is. It's not only there's a Play-Doh tower, but there's a show that I do, a live show, where we take you back to complete darkness before the Big Bang.
Okay.
And then I slowly introduce you to light and color and the atomic world and then the electromagnetic spectrum. And then from there, I get into the different things about... That one of the things that I've realized is that the way color has been taught since for a long time has been antiquated. It was created during the Middle Ages, not Middle Ages, but by after the Renaissance.
Okay.
They started learning the red, yellow, and blue color mixing thing. But technology has changed everything.
Sure.
With everybody working on their cell phones and Photoshop and stuff, and then CMYK printing but they haven't really upgraded the teaching methods.
No.
So what I found is that I saw this kind of gap there. So I started developing this program, and this show is a prototype for a show that I hope to take to comic book conventions and then eventually to schools, and then hopefully start putting out a teaching package that will change how color is taught.
Sure. Have you thought about like doing some video products of it, just even if it's free, like on YouTube, so people can actually explore the idea, and then from there be piqued and find out about some of your events?
Yes, that's kind of one of the things that's happening throughout the course of my show. I have a man coming in, and we've been videotaping it, trying to put together some sort of presentation that we can put together into short YouTube clips that will kind of, if you watch several of them, people's attention span is very short nowadays, so relatively.
Okay. It's up and down.
Yeah.
I feel like it is a fact that people, they decide that they've lost interest quickly.
Right.
Whereas before they had less things to look at.
Right.
And so I personally feel like sometimes it's not that they have a shorter attention span, but they've gotten better at realizing they don't want to look anymore.
Oh, right. Then they have many, many more options.
Yeah. Because, and that's just it. Like, sometimes they'll watch two or three things and they'll pick one to focus on. You know, kids will do that. They have multiple windows available. Before it was, you know, we had a TV channel. There was maybe seven channels. You knew that you hated three of the channels. And on the four that were remaining, there was only one show worth watching at a time. Right. So it was real easy to focus there if you were watching something.
Right.
When you're reading a book, you pick a book. And, you know, we were taught from school to start the book, finish the book, and then report on the book. As we get older and we learn that we don't have to finish the book, we don't always finish the book.
That's true.
And sometimes we read three or four books in sessions. I'm not that guy. My wife is definitely that person, though. Right. She goes to the library, gets 17 books, and reads all of them in pieces until she has to return them, and she's finished two, and she's learned what she wanted out of five, and the other ones just didn't make the cut.
Okay.
You know, and I think we do that with new media, too, is like we start out by scrolling through stuff. We pick something we want to see. We watch it for a while. If we lose interest, I don't know that we've really lost interest. We've lost focus every time. Sometimes we do.
Of course.
I think a lot of times we lose focus, and other times I think that we just stop caring about things that aren't important right away because we have a lot of choices.
Right, exactly.
You know, I'm finding that even like just with the nature of the business in general with the co-op is that people are no longer, you know, there is no such thing with the way that, you know, technology, transportation, you know, marketing from various things, you know, fads in food, like there's no such thing as a captive audience anymore. You have to be captivating, you know?
Yes.
And I think that you might have something there for
Well,
sure.
And that was the whole point. What I wanted to do was I wanted to have sort of an intellectual side of the show and then a hands-on approach, because we have not only the Play-Doh Tower, where people, it's been so cool to watch people make these different things and stick them on the tower. And then we also have some things where you can lift up and see color separation and CMYK stuff. And then I finally got the soap film painting exhibit working.
Okay.
Which
sounds like it was challenging.
Oh, it was, and it still is. It's got some refinements to go, but it's something I saw at the Exploratorium years ago. And it's, you make this giant flat bubble, and it just does this psychedelic stuff. It's almost impossible to describe, but what I wanted the whole show to be was an experiential thing.
Yeah. So let's go back a lot farther now. You've been in Point Arena for how long?
My mom was the first postmaster when Sea Ranch opened up, so I moved to Gualala in 1965.
Okay.
And I have since then we moved slowly from Gualala to Anchor Bay and finally to Point Arena. And I left out to go to college and found I didn't like it and came back and went to Manchester. So I'd hit all the towns and then finally came back to Point Arena because Point Arena was the city that adopted me.
Yeah, it felt like home.
Well, it was. But I mean, like, I left home when I was a junior in high school. My mom had a kind of abusive alcoholic stepfather. I mean, her husband was my stepfather.
Sure.
And I left home and decided I wasn't going to go back. But what they did is that they rented me an apartment in Point Arena.
Okay.
So I was the only kid in high school who had his own apartment. And it turned out that I bought the property that I owned there, and my business, Ole Optics, started really in that apartment. And so now I still own that property.
Right. So, obviously, an interesting comic books happen.
Yes.
So, there are going to be people that don't know anything about Ole Optics.
Okay.
That don't know anything about comic books except that they exist.
Yes.
Okay. So let's start, like, can you give me at least a reasonable summary of the Ole Optics story? Like,
sure.
Where it came from, how you decided you wanted to color, where the technology came from on that part of it?
Yep, I can. It started in Los Banos when I was in the third grade, and Marvel Comics had come out with Spider-Man number one. And then soon after, X-Men number one and Avengers number one. I was their target market.
Yeah.
And my mom had, we'd been living in L.A., and it wasn't working out. It was kind of, so my mom and dad had split up, so she sent me to live with my aunt and uncle there. But she felt guilty about it, so she gave me a set of artist-grade Prismacolor colored pencils. A full set, 120 colored pencils with all the metallics and everything. Well, all of my friends had 8 or 16 crayons. And then Marvel Comics came out. And then from the bottom of a Play-Doh pack, I learned color theory. And my career, I tell everybody that 6 months in Los Banos, when I was in the third grade, set my whole career in motion. Because I started drawing and got into comics. We moved up here. I kept drawing and kept drawing. And I just never kind of gave up my dream. And what happened was, I hung out with a bunch of artists, and they were better artists than I was, but I had a knack for color. So I started honing in on color, and I started doing, got a little job here, and then I got, went back to New York, because I'd done a couple of color pieces. I've worked for Howard Chaykin, who was a color blind artist, who was working on the first one of the first graphic novels, The Star Is My Destination, by Alfred Bester. And when the job was ended, he said, "Steve, I don't have any more work for you. So let me take you up to DC and Marvel." DC didn't have any work for me, but Marvel did. Marvel was publishing, because at the time, the Hulk was on TV with Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno, and Marvel was doing a more adult version, full color version of the Hulk. So I did a tryout, and I was able to come back to Manchester and basically start working, making Manhattan wages, but in Manchester.
Nice. Just to be clear on that, not to interrupt too much, but
no.
Was there actually a time where the comics weren't all in full color?
Yes.
Okay.
Prior to 1978.
This is a big breakthrough. This is where you came in.
It was a big breakthrough. I was a full color specialist where all the other colors were the 64 color, the big dots and the kind of crappy stuff, but I was not doing that. I was doing the full color. But then, right around the time the Atari 800 came out, I started seeing the potential for computers. And American comics were trying to catch up with Europe for doing full color stuff. They were trying a bunch of different things. And then in 1988, I got the job to color Akira, which is, it was a major manga.
Yeah.
And then it became a huge hit as far as an anime over in America. But I asked them, we tried a couple of tests doing the old school thing. I said, "Hey, listen, I got this guy who's got this software. Could I do it with a computer?" And they said, "Hey, sure, if it meets our price point." And it did. And the rest is history, because Ole Optics suddenly became the first time a color guide artist was also the color separator.
Yeah.
And with a tool that would allow me to have millions of colors. And I had a great crew, and it was a miracle, but I had a succession of really talented people showing up and working first in my place where, you know, up at Outback where the pet supply stays. Mm-hmm. That was my office. And then we moved up to my property there once I bought that.
Yeah.
And from there, at the peak of Ole Optics, we had 22 people working here. And I would tell people, come on up and see if a job finds you.
Yeah.
Because what I found is that people would come up from LA and they would say, "Yeah, I want to work for you, but I'm not sure I can live in this little town."
Oh, yeah.
So, So it was the whole thing about, like, yeah, if you can handle our little town, it works. So Natalie's boyfriend, Michael Jeremiah, was a guy who came out from the East Coast. And another guy, Quinn Suplee, came up here. He came up in a suit and tie. He didn't know what to expect here. And I just said, "Yeah, okay." And he worked for me for years.
Right.
And yeah, but we had a lot of local talent that it was like, Ole Optics was the kind of cool, hip place to work, and because we were doing cutting edge stuff.
Yeah.
And it was, there was such a good vibe there. I realized eventually, after all the spin-off companies started happening, that it was impossible to replace the talent that I had, because it was a miracle that they had been here in the first place.
It helps.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you get lucky on that, I mean, it's a dice roll.
But you know, Ole Optics changed the comic book world, because we were the first to do computer color separation, and for about 3 or 4 years there, we kind of had the monopoly on it.
Yeah, I mean, I've been in the room as people who have been a part of that story have had a chance to tell their little piece of the story and get their own moment of celebrityness just from being a part of it. Right. When they find somebody who has a sense of comic book history, just randomly off the street, and next thing you know, they're talking about Steve Olaf, Ole Optics. I'm like, oh my gosh, that was here.
It was real. It was right here in town.
And then you have people like me who read comics, and I didn't even, like I said, short of reading the paper in black and white, I didn't realize that they were naturally that way, because I mean, really, everything was black and white for a while because it was just much easier. Adding color is a whole other level of technology.
Well, you know, but like what I, the thing with Akira was just about to come out with the anime, the movie version, and it was wildly popular in Japan. But when they approached Marvel about doing it, the Epic line with Archie Goodwin, God rest his soul, he was the best editor in the business. They came, and they thought the American audience was not quite ready for black and white comics. But, so that's why they sent out tests, and mine succeeded, and I went back there, and then when we got the computer going, it was like it just revolutionized everything, because no one had seen colors like that before.
Yeah, and that's the point. I mean, whenever the technology makes it that much more vivid, that much more real, you've got something.
Right.
You know, no matter what it is, the experience is improved. I mean, the world falls in love with it.
Exactly.
I think that's.
And I was
great.
Like, and so what I've been very. Then we started winning some awards and stuff, and then the image explosion happened with Spawn and the Max and all those guys, and they took it over the top.
Yeah. And then
high gloss
and high quality.
And
stuff,
actually, I'm responsible
paper.
For the high gloss paper, because Rob Liefeld wanted his book to look better, his Youngblood book, to look better than Spawn, which mm-hmm. is my main thing. And I said, well, you know, you could use gloss paper. And it gives a little bit of extra sheen.
Makes it look higher quality. It looks premium.
Exactly. And then everybody switched over. So it's Rob Liefeld's fault.
So you're familiar with like some of like the holofoil and, you know,
yeah.
foil stuff. Now, is that something that has happened in comic books much? I mean, like I play a trading card game where,
yep.
you know, foil cards are the premium cards.
They
and
are.
Some people hate them. Some people love them because the way they curl the pages and the way
right.
the films work and stuff. Is that something that you ever worked with?
I only a little bit, because what that was that was their trick variant covers. The Image guys started doing all these foil things that people started kind of like dissing it a little bit, just
sure.
as too much of a gimmick.
Yep.
You know, which I kind of agreed, but it was cool. I understood.
It's art.
It's marketing.
Yep.
And it's like you could sell an extra 15,000 copies if you did a foil cover variant.
Right. They'd have to buy two, one for
exactly.
the one for the sleeve and one to read.
And that's the thing. Then the Image comics when do you know the story of Image?
I don't know any stories about comics except the one we're talking about
okay.
right now.
Well, Image Image Comics started because all of the comic artists started rebelling that they weren't getting royalties. Okay? So what Marvel did is that they brought their seven top creators in for a big meeting up at the Perlman Tower or wherever it was. I'm not sure exactly where it was then. And then the top brass at Marvel went upstairs and was having this big meeting, but they left all of the guys, the creators, alone. And they started saying, why do we need Marvel?
Mm-hmm.
Let's make our own thing. We can challenge them. So they formed Image Comics because they got 100%. And the first issue of Spawn, I think, sold 1.5 million issues. And was like, and these guys were getting... They didn't have to get like a 10%, 15% royalty. They got it all. All they had to do was pay all the publishing stuff.
Right, they had a business.
They had a business, and they suddenly were millionaires. And it was like, because they were the top talent that Marvel had. And it was an extreme blunder on Marvel's part, but just good for the Image guys.
For sure. And now, are they still active? Do they have the same name?
The Image Comics is still around. Image publishes The Walking Dead.
Okay.
The Spawn is still out there, Savage Dragon. A lot of the...
More adult, darker comics.
Yeah, and independent.
But yeah.
There's like, they will, if you do your own marketing, they will help you publish.
That sounds like pretty ideal.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it lets anybody with any talent who believes in themselves get a shot.
Right, and what they learned is that what you have to do is you have to have a completed project, you have to have all your team together. You know, you cannot just say, I've got an idea for something and then get funded.
You need a project.
You get your stuff out there and they will support you. But you've got to do the work.
Yeah. Well,
so,
I mean, that's experience talking.
Well, exactly. They know that the Image guys initially... See, the guy I worked for mostly was Todd McFarlane, Spawn. And he had a philosophy. He kept a stripped-down crew. It was him and his Terry McFadden, his guy. They got their issues out on time. He put out a book every month because he knew that one of the things about you got to do is you got to be consistent.
Consistency.
And all these other guys would get their $1 million checks from the first issue, and then they would fart around for months, and it'd be 3 months before they got second issue.
Yeah.
And Todd, no. He paid us a fair rate for the coloring, but he gave us an $8,000 a month bonus if we got it in on time. So believe me, I paid bonuses to my guys if we got it in on time.
Now, did you write this software?
No.
Or did you work with someone on that part?
Nope. We had nothing to do with the software creation. It was like, interestingly enough, I risked my entire, everything to go to Philadelphia one time for a comic book convention. Not a comic book convention, it was a computer convention called the SIGGRAPH. I had seen an article, because I've been trying to look for computer stuff for years. I saw an article in Computer Graphics World, tiny little thing that said, there's a guy who's developed this software to color comics, and they're going to do an Iron Man graphic novel. So I thought, all right, I'm going to go. I called and called and called, tried to get a room. So I just said, I'm going. Got on the plane. Had no idea where I was going to stay that night.
Yeah.
The lady sitting next to me happened to be a broker for bed and breakfast in Philly. The next thing I know, I get off the plane, she calls somebody, and I'm staying in a room for a lady who works for the Board of Education in downtown Philly. You know, it's Saturday night, I'm sleeping in her son's spare bunk bed.
The first Airbnb.
Exactly. You know.
You did everything.
And then, she goes and tells me, okay, so, I'm sitting there with them at 7 o'clock at night, I'm going like, God, I don't want to just hang out with these. I don't want to impose on this lady and her kid. So I said, is there anything going on? She says, yeah, South Street's right down there. I don't know if you've ever been to Philly, but apparently South Street is the thing. So I go start walking, and I'm walking down the street, and I'm looking around. It's getting really dark, and there's some kind of bombed-out looking buildings, and I'm getting nervous. Because, growing up around here, there's not much cultural difference and not much race.
It's a bubble.
Things. We're in a bubble. It's a white bubble. And I'm the only white guy walking around there. And I'm walking, I guess I must have looked pretty nervous. Because there are these two middle-aged black guys sitting on this bench.
What year was it?
1987.
All right.
Okay. I'm walking down Philly South Street, and this guy looks up at me and goes, what you afraid of? Ain't nobody gonna hurt you. And I looked at him, and he didn't smile. He was dead serious.
He was right.
And what it was that I got over my fear, and I was invincible there. I just went for it. I just figured, okay. So I kept walking down. Suddenly there's all these bars and clubs and music, and I went and hung out with the Cool Saw and Animation Festival, went to the convention, looked at it, and the guy that I needed to see had one little tiny slot the very last day, the very last hour of the last day of the convention, which meant I had to buy the ticket for the whole thing. So I maxed out my credit card. But I hung out there. I met this cool woman holographer, and we hung out. We went to the Philadelphia Museum of Art. I got to see this amazing Rodin sculpture museum there, and I met the guy at the end and exchanged cards. So he had this guy, Mike Science, who was going to work with him to do this Iron Man graphic novel. But Mike was a Mac guy, and this guy had a PC program. So the last minute, Mike dumped him and went off and worked with his buddy who had a Mac program. So this guy had no place to show off his software. So when I talked to him, we worked out a deal. He gave me a machine and the software, and he would get all the money from the film output and all that's the other side of the thing. So suddenly, right about Christmas, 1988, I'm sitting there and I get this package. I've suddenly got software where I am changing the comic book world, sitting there, on my own, trying to figure out how to work this stuff.
So his was the model where he created the equipment and then sold the consumable.
Yes.
That makes perfect sense.
Yeah,
that happens a lot. And so that made perfect for you because you could run your business and just buy the consumable.
Right.
He had a solid business and you had exactly the tool you needed to make it work.
Exactly.
That's awesome.
And it worked out, and I was right here in Point Arena.
All because you got lost in Philly in 1987. That's perfect.
Yeah, man, it was great. I went to all black jazz clubs. Nobody was in there. The young guys would be glaring at me. The old guys was going, like, why are you here? I said, tell them, what the hell? I bought a gold chain from a junkie at 2 in the morning, and I felt I had carte blanche.
Yeah.
I was protected.
You were in the zone.
I was.
That's good.
And that trip to Philly changed my entire life.
Yeah. In so many ways.
Yes.
Yeah, and then you landed here.
Well, I had been here already, but,
yeah.
You know.
Well, but you came back different.
I came back different, and I was able to bring that technology. And also, one of the things that had happened when I first went to New York was I'd learned the concept of being able to get New York money, but live here.
Yeah.
I mean, because the only reason I could do it back in 1978 was that there was this brand new thing that had happened called Express Mail.
Nice.
So, but then, you know, then FedEx came along and
sure,
then
it
the
got
internet,
easier.
It yeah. got easier and easier.
So, and now, do you still do any color work?
A little bit, not yeah. too much.
Yeah, you, I mean, I, we have your book in the store.
Right.
The
Guide Dog.
Yes, the Guide Dog, which is like sort of a, it's the next thing that you kind of came up with after Armature, right?
Pretty much. Well, what it was it was a collection of Armature strips that were local.
Yeah.
I realized that there was a need for some kind of a guidebook for our area.
Yeah. And and it seems to be working well. We've sold quite a few copies, and other
I've
places
sold a little
too.
Over 1,000 of them so far.
In how long?
It came out last March.
Nice. In a population of 500 people.
Yeah.
And about the same number of tourists. That's amazing.
Not bad.
Yeah. Okay. So another question for you is, you know, you've worked on hundreds of comics, if not thousands mm-hmm. now. Is there any project of all of them that you'd say was like a favorite project that you worked on?
Yes. The Max.
Okay.
I don't know if you've ever heard of the Max. The Max was just this quirky image project that was by a friend of mine named Sam Keith.
Okay.
And it was, of most of the image stuff was kind of juvenile. I mean, like, it's superheroes and stuff. But the Max was complex. It was dark. It was well-drawn, really interesting. It was one of the most fun projects I've worked on. I mean, the other one was the very first Sandman project I worked on
okay.
with Neil Gaiman.
Nice.
And that was a story, Midsummer Night's Dream, issue of a thing of Sandman number 19. And it has an interesting story is that I met Neil Gaiman when we were both nominated for awards at the Harvey Awards in Dallas, Texas. And the first year we both got skunked. And so we just hung out in the bar and drank and commiserated.
Well, at least we've made it here.
Yeah, So but the next year we both got nominated again. We both won. He won for Sandman, I won for Akira. And then so we talked and we said, someday hopefully we can work together. So years down the road, I talked to him and he said, look, let's do Sandman. So it was an issue drawn by a really good artist, Charles Vess. And it was an amazing story that turned out won the World Science Fiction Fantasy Award for Best Short Story. And the science fiction writers freaked out. They were not liking the fact that a comic book had won their best short story. So they changed the rules so that no graphic novel, no comic story could ever win again.
Everybody wants to be a princess.
Well, but it's cool. But I figured, that's great. I got to work on a comic that won this World Science Fiction Award.
It changed the rules.
Right. But what was cool about this story, it was brilliant. What the character of Sandman is this kind of eternal, mm-hmm. his dream. Okay.
Oh, well, no, they don't, though. Tell me the story. Sorry.
Well, Sandman is dream. He's a part of one of the Eternals, and he would step into, and he would come into all different time frames, everything. And what this was a story about, Sandman had made a deal with William Shakespeare to write this play about the gods, Titania and Oberon, the lords of the fairyland.
Sure.
And there was this one big thing on, I think that they, it might be a real thing. I mean, because one thing I liked about working with Neil, he's one of the most well-read authors I've ever encountered. His scripts were so much fun to read because he'd go off on his like paragraphs describing all this stuff that wouldn't be in the thing, but it would be background. Anyway, so there's this thing where the Lords of Faerie were able to come through and Shakespeare and his troupe went out to this spot and they performed for Pan and Titania and Oberon and all the characters from A Midsummer Night's Dream. And he set the play up, I mean, he set the comic up brilliantly. So there was the gods, fairy gods, sitting out in the audience watching themselves. Then there was the actual play where he quoted from Shakespeare. And then he showed the backstage with all these people going like, those are the real gods out there. And it was just a brilliant piece of work.
Nice.
So, anyway, Sandman 19.
And what was the worst? Was there one that was just terrible, whether it was because of people or style? Like, was there one that you just really were glad it was over?
Yes, but I'd rather not tell you what it was because people would be bummed.
Understand. You don't want to hurt any old friends' feelings.
No, there were occasionally you would have stuff that was so horrible.
Like just the content?
Just content, the art, really bad, the disgusting stories.
Sure.
It was just a paycheck.
Just feeding, yeah. Yeah, well, that's fair enough. I've done some unusual projects. I did bronze casting for a while, and you'd get the occasional request for something that would not be within your personal code of what's worth reproducing.
Right.
But you needed to eat.
Right.
And the thing was, is you were maybe making a replica of something that was already real.
Right.
You know, and it was unfortunate, but eating was a priority.
Exactly. And the motto at Ole Optics used to be, the better you draw, the better we color.
I like that.
Yeah.
It's pretty valid. I don't know. I tell staff at the store all the time, our new people, I tell them, we're not a specialty store. I say, mm-hmm. We're a regular store for specialty right. people.
There you go.
And, you know,
same kind of concept.
Same exact idea. Yeah. It's like, you know, whoever you're creating an experience for, you know, you're going to make the experience that's working for them, hopefully, the right. best you can.
Well, I was just telling you about this guy from Spain who got in touch with me about the Avengers Forever
yeah.
and stuff. Carlos Pacheco's art was so good. But I wouldn't let any of my assistants work on it.
Nice.
I just did, I put everything I had into right on the guides. I've wanted it to be, well, I just figured it deserved it.
Sure.
You know, and it's like, because some jobs you just kind of go like, okay, you do a bunch of that, and then I'll come in and touch it up.
Sure. But sometimes you can just delegate, and other times you don't want anyone else in.
Exactly.
Fair enough. So you were mentioning some work with him and a project that you might be picking up in Spanish?
What it is there's a possibility, and I'm not saying this is not set in stone.
You're not bragging, got it.
No, right. But he does a Marvel Age thing where they talk about Marvel comics and the different things. And I was thinking about scanning in some things because I did a bunch of really cool Marvel. See, okay, let me just backtrack.
Sure.
Computers came into comic books in 1988 with Akira.
Okay.
It lasted, and the way we would do it is I would do a detailed, beautiful color guide. I mean, I'd paint it, I'd make these things works of art, and then I'd trust my computer guys to try to translate it, and then I'd play art director, massage it until we got to the final stage and get it to print. But there were beautiful color guides being done, not just by me, but because we set that kind of standard, everybody was doing them. Eventually, Marvel decided, Joe Quesada, the editor-in-chief, decided that he did not want to pay for a color guide artist and then a color separator. So what he did is he made everybody who was now using Photoshop to color things, they had to do the whole thing. So there were no more color guides after 2000. So really, there's an era of nice color guides from Akira through 2000, which is about 12 years, and so
sort of the vinyl or the
exactly
you know it's the that vinyl of comic book color.
Same thing, because now there is no, I mean, you get the computer color, it goes straight to press. There's no artifacts left over, but the color guides.
Do you have a collection of those?
I have thousands of them.
That sounds rad.
And what I did is, in the old days, you used to have to like write numbers on them and stuff, and I always hated that.
Yeah.
So I would, if I had to do that, I'd put it on an overlay. So I'd look at, and I'm going back through the color guides themselves, man, I would use airbrush, gouache, color pencil. Sure. I would make those things look shiny.
How big are they?
They're generally print size.
Would you be interested at some point in doing a little gallery wall at the store?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah? Let's talk about that.
Yeah.
I think it'd be great to just do like a really fun, like just...
Well, you know, one of the things that has sold the best at my show is I sold an Akira color guide, a Spider-Woman color guide, an Avengers Forever cover color guide.
Now, so, are they the originals or do you sell prints?
These are the originals.
You think prints are a thing?
Not for the color guides, because I don't own the copyright to them.
Right.
All I do is I own the physical art. My color guy, they always give it back.
It's the original.
It's proof. Yeah.
Got it.
So, but I do sell prints of my armature strips.
For sure. And that would be a thing, too. Well, I know I have some slots coming up, so we can talk about some stuff in the store.
Absolutely.
I think that'd be great, actually.
Yeah.
You know?
It'd be fun.
Yeah. Is there anything you want to share about the art show coming up?
Well, my show is probably one of the most unique approaches to color that I've ever tried. It's like I tell everybody, it's a cross between a comic book convention, an exploratorium science show, and Disneyland. With hands-on, as well as that, and then as for the live shows, I take you back to pitch darkness before the Big Bang, then slowly introduce you to light and color and the electromagnetic spectrum, and then describe some of the different worlds of color. And it's up for another about 2 weeks, and it's a prototype for a thing I would like to take to conventions and perhaps schools.
So you want to get it out in the world then?
Yeah. Well,
and
I mean, I
set up a tour.
Well, yeah, but well, what basically, I've developed some teaching methods and some, I think, a new way to approach color that could revolutionize the way color is taught. And I mean,
it seems like a whole curriculum almost.
Yeah, exactly.
Like an art curriculum that maybe could be, you know, at the college level.
Right. It can go from grade school through college, and you can steer into science because color is science.
Yeah.
And then back again into art because the name of the show is One Universe of Light, Four Worlds of Color.
Yeah.
And what the worlds of color are, your eyes. Well, the universe out here. Is we see it all in RGB. It's
yeah.
Red, green, and blue primaries. That's how our eyes see. And then in the computer world, in every digital device, your cell phone, yep. whatever, they have an RGB component because that's how it displays its color.
That's how we see, right.
And then it's red, yellow, and blue paint mixing, which is the traditional way. But then if you want to go out to print, there's cyan, magenta, yellow, and black.
Right.
So. All those worlds kind of overlap, and they have certain things that are the same and certain things that aren't. So but the basic worlds are RGB, red, yellow, blue, CMYK, and the fourth world is the world of art, okay. which is how you take those colors and create something out
sure.
of them. Because you have an emotional response to color before you even identify what it is you're looking at. And that's what I realized. So the point of my show is to help people learn how to see with better eyes. Because our brain acts as a filter, and we really don't see the world around us. We kind of go like, oh, that's a tree, that's a car, that's that. But if you look at all the details, and you really look at it, it can be pretty fascinating.
A lot more intense.
A lot more intense.
Absolutely. Well, thanks a lot, Steve.
Awesome.
And thanks for coming,
thanks.
And we'll see you at the co-op.
My pleasure. Yeah, okay.
Again, this is Steve Olive of Oli Optics and other comic and light and color entertainment. He's got an art show coming up in Gualala at the Gualala Art Center until what date again?
It's on until the 28th of February.
Until the 28th. Is there any days that it's closed, or is it every single day?
It's open, but I only do the live shows. I mean, tomorrow night, which is Friday the 16th, I'm doing a live show at 6:15, and then Saturdays and Sundays at 2 p.m., I'm doing the live shows. And on the 24th, which is a Saturday, it's free comic book day.
Awesome. We'll have to get out there for that as well. All right. Well, thanks a lot, and we'll see you at the co-op.
Awesome. Thanks.